This is the Warrior Mind Podcast, and I'm your host, Greg Swanson. Podcasting from beautiful Bend, Oregon, the Warrior Mind Podcast is a personal empowerment series that provides you the information required to develop a mindset of a warrior, maximize your human potential, and achieve peak performance. The Warrior Mind Podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes and links can be found at www.warriormindcoach.com/blog. Please come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. If you're returning, thank you for your continued support. This is episode 340, and today I have another special interview with a gentleman, awesome, awesome guy. His name is Marcus Aurelius Anderson. First of all, how cool is that as a first name, right? Marcus Aurelius. You can imagine what his parents are thinking and where he gains his motivation from. But Marcus was in the 10th Mountain, very similar to where my son was in, and was deployed and suffered a spinal injury that left him less than adequate mobility. He basically was paralyzed. He went through several things. I'm not going to give away the whole story because that's what the interview is about. But this gentleman really, really knows what mental strength is about. And one of the things that I love about it is he talks about embracing adversity. And adversity is good for us. And we need to have adversity in our lives to see what we are made out of. So with that, I don't want to prolong this anymore. With that, sit back and really just enjoy this conversation. Go look him up. I'll put some links to his sites on this page here, but you can find him on Facebook. You can find him on LinkedIn. You can find him on Instagram. But please go check it out. This guy is very, very, very inspirational. He's gone through a lot in life. And please enjoy this interview with Marcus Aurelius Anderson. Marcus, thank you so much for joining me today. It's just, you know, we connected last week on LinkedIn. I saw your TED talk and was just amazed by it. And I'm so glad that you're able to take some time out and chat with me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
So for those that don't know, I mean, my podcast goes to seven continents, over 500,000 downloads. So there's people in the United States, over in Asia, Canada and stuff. For those that don't know you, could you give a little bit of background of your story? Because it's just, it's an amazing story. And then we'll get into how you maneuvered your way through those challenges.
Absolutely, Greg. Well, the story of my injury was probably the biggest component. I was serving in the military in 2012. And in the preparation leading up to deployment, there's always a lot of intense training. And what ended up happening was I ruptured a disc in my neck. The disc ruptured, but the way that they described it on the MRI is they said it looked like it exploded because it was so, you know, violent, I guess.
And just out of curiosity, how did that happen? I mean, how do you rupture a disc or explode a disc, I should ask?
Yeah, I guess that was what was interesting. There was no specific method of onset. What must have happened from what they're telling me, the neurologist said that the disc must have been inflamed and bulging for a long, long time. And maybe some of it was already starting to, because everybody will say that they have a bulging disc or that they have like a ruptured disc. But a truly ruptured disc is one that ruptures so much that the stuff inside of the disc, it's like a jelly donut. When the stuff on the inside comes out and it presses into your spinal cord, that's when you have trouble. But all the different training that we've been doing, I'd always had some of the symptomatology. We were always training outside in the snow and the ice. So when we would go for a run, I was having trouble feeling my feet. When we would do pull-ups or climb ropes, I'd have a hard time feeling. And my hand strength has always been really strong. So it was one of those things. It's like, well, it's just because it's cold, or, oh, it's just because we haven't got any sleep, or, oh, we just haven't got any food.
Right.
So that's why I feel like that. But then that week when everything started happening, we did a 50% ruck, they call it. So you take 50% of your body weight and you put it in a rucksack, and then you're doing a 10-mile ruck with 50 pounds of body armor, your weapon system, your helmet, your gas mask, and you're trying to go as fast as you can. It ends up turning into a run is what it does. So in negative 20 degree weather, running with all that stuff on, but that's what you have to do if you're going to deploy. You have to be ready, correct?
Yep.
So, and that's what helps train your mind in a lot of those ways. Eventually that, by the end of that week though, when I woke up completely paralyzed. I couldn't move. I woke up on a Saturday morning trying to move. My head would move a little bit, but the rest of my body wouldn't move. And at first I was like, oh, I'm just sore, or oh, I'm just stiff. Mm-hmm. And nothing moved. And that's when I realized I was in trouble.
What was in your mind at that time?
I was scared to death. It was like my worst fear realized at that point. It's almost like being buried alive or drowning, because I didn't know what to do. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, okay. And I'm trying to do all the, if you get injured, they always say that you need to do like a self eval. Like if you get shot, you should wipe your body for blood or whatever it is. And I'm trying to go through these evals and I'm realizing, well, nothing's going on. So I'm paralyzed basically. And then when it started actually hitting me, that's when I started freaking out. I started yelling. Yeah. Somebody was able to come to my door and get me. And that's when the nightmare started.
So. And so then from there, they took you to the operating room, or where did they do it when they removed you from your facility there?
They took me to the Fort Drum medic area, to the triage there. Mm-hmm. And they, honestly, they didn't believe me. They thought that I was faking it.
Right.
So, they kind of let me sit for a while. And then eventually when it got to the point where obviously I'm having a hard time breathing. My body's not functioning. That's when they got me on a lift and they sent me to Syracuse, okay. New York, which is about an hour south of Fort Drum.
Right.
And, as soon as they got me there, they had a whole team, you know, it looked like a horrible scene out of a movie where you have everybody shining lights in your eyes and you have a cardiologist doing something as you're on the triage and then running down there and, they got me in the MRI immediately and they operated on me within hours because they knew they were going to lose me.
So what happened in the operating room? Something interesting happened a couple of times, right?
Oh, yeah, interesting for sure. When the disc ruptured, it paralyzed me because it put all that pressure on my spinal cord, and that's why I wasn't able to move. So when they sent me in to give me the operation, I was trying to process everything, and then eventually they just put the gas mask on me so I could actually start going through anesthesia. And they said, just count back from 100. I got to about 98. And then it got real cold and real dark. And then I just kind of came back, and all of a sudden I'm in ICU. And they tell me after the fact, after a couple of days of letting all the medication go through my body, because I was on a lot of pain meds. And again, I'm in ICU. I still can't move. I'm in a neck brace. I can barely talk because they've been shoving stuff down my throat. The doctor comes in and says, hey, you had us worried for a little bit. And I'm like, what are you worried about? I'm the guy that was getting cut on. And they said, yeah, we lost you. And I was like, where'd you put me? Right. You mean you lost me? And he says, we lost you a few times, actually, a couple of times. And after he said that, I was really, I could see his mouth moving, but I couldn't really hear anything else. I was sort of fixated on that. But he was very congratulatory in his tone. So he was like, hey, man, you know, that's the last thing I heard him say before I kind of went back into my sleep was, you know, you live to tell the tale. You've died and come back. So,
wow. So lucky. Do you, I don't know what the word is, remember, but do you remember experiencing that part of the procedure when you were no longer in your body here?
There's a lot of different people that will have different experiences.
Yep.
All I can tell you is my experience. And my experience was that I saw something very profound, something very definitive, and it was nothing. I just saw black is all I saw.
Right.
I didn't leave my body. I didn't see anything. I couldn't see myself from a third person perspective.
What did you sense at that point? If you go back in your memory, what, you know, cause some of us are very visual with our remembrance. Others feel it. So what did you, if you go back, what did you feel? What did you sense at that point?
I just felt very cold.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just dark and I just felt very cold. So I would love to be able to tell you an amazing story
cause my follow up question to this is which you were, and I don't want to say dead, but if you weren't with, if they lost you.
Yeah, of course.
And you were feeling cold. Who was it that was feeling that cold if you were no longer with us?
That's exactly it. That's why it's hard to, you know, it's hard to say. I've read stories and about people that have died. And, you know, there was a person that gave me a book called 90 Minutes in Heaven and all these things. So definitely there's something going on for some people. I can't really speak on that. All I can speak on is my experience. And like you say, somebody had to experience that. Something had to be able to feel that, you know? So I don't know either.
So just on a side note to, I don't want to say support what you said, but when I was in an avalanche, right, you hear these people about, they're getting in a car accident, their life goes before their eyes, before they hit the car. None of that happened for me. None of it happened. I didn't see my life go in front of me. I didn't see any of that. So I guess it all depends on each individual. So, you know, although there was a person that did die on our avalanche, I was kind of disappointed that I didn't have this euphoric feeling and stuff going like, wow, what's wrong with me? How come I'm not seeing my life pass in front of me?
That's kind of what I did. People were, you know, asking me the same thing, or, well, I know a person who did this and they saw this, that, and the other. And, you know, I don't know, that maybe their biochemistry was different than mine. There's plenty of research that talks about all the chemicals that are released whenever we die, all the things that can simulate different things. Mm-hmm. So, and I respect everybody's experiences, whatever they had. If it was something that was, there's some people that they do that and that kind of helps them rekindle a belief system or a religion that they had before. And if that's what they do, then that's great.
Right. So this was really just a beginning again to a more strenuous challenge that you faced. Yeah, you faced death. You came back a couple of times, but that wasn't the end of it. What happened after that?
That was just the beginning. I look at it like it's my blank slate. I was 40 years old. In my TED talk, I talk about that's my opening line, but I say that, you know, I turned 40 years old, broke, divorced, bedridden, and paralyzed because I had no idea what was going to happen next. I was in that bed. I laid there for a long time. I laid there for months. Nobody wanted to tell me that I would never walk again, but it just sort of happened. I was doing physical therapy, and I was asking them as they were, because they would actually mobilize my limbs and my appendages for me on like a bicycle or a similar apparatus. And I asked one of the people, I said, so when am I going to get to do this? And the physical therapy assistant, the PT kind of smirked. And I was like, no, I mean, because even before I went into the operation, like, you know, don't worry about it. Just get through the operation. Right. And then they would just kick it down the road. Well, don't worry about it. Just get through your first week, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then I found out basically the consensus was if you don't walk within the first couple of days, because all that pressure on my spinal cord, once they take that pressure off, it should work.
Right.
And if it doesn't after that, then you've got a lot of, you know, permanent spinal damage, a lot of neurological damage. And he kind of looked at me. He says, well, you know, that's not going to happen.
What went through your mind when you heard that? What, I mean, that had to be, I mean, you've gone through so many shocks, right? First you wake up in your bunk, you can't move. And then you're told you were dead for a couple of times. And now they're saying, you know what? You survived those things, but you know what? You're not going to walk anymore. What went through your mind?
I was livid. I was absolutely just madder than I'd been about pretty much anything.
Wow.
Because at that point, you almost go through those bargaining, those five, you know, stages of grief. You go through the bargaining, the denial, all that stuff. And I had had a little bit of movement at one point, so I was starting to get excited, but then I went right back to square one. So then when he said this and I'm still waiting, I'm like, well, maybe it'll happen again. He's like, you know, man, it's not going to happen. If it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. So that's when I got to probably my very lowest, deepest depression. I went back to my room because that's all I could do is he would put me in a room, turn on, you know, whatever was on Netflix or whatever, and just kind of let me watch the come and check on me or bring me food. And eventually I got to the point where I was like, don't even turn it on. I need to internalize this. I need to process this. I need to figure this out.
Yeah.
Because being distracted is fine, but it keeps you from focusing on what's going on. And I'm very much a, let me figure this out. Let me think about this. I can figure something out if you give me enough time. But this was by far the greatest.
Right. So when you say figure something out in this particular case, what did that look like to you? What did that sound like to you in your head?
That's where it was tough because I'm sitting here thinking to myself, well, what's the lesson to be learned from here? What can I take from this? What is the positive in this? And I was left with nothing for a long time.
At some point, did you and I don't want to go into a dark part here, because the ending of the story is amazing. So we'll just let the listeners know that it's a very happy ending. So hang in there with us. But at some point, did you wish that you just didn't come back from the table?
I really did. In my TED talk, I talk about how, you know, I actually got to the point, because people that are depressed is actually anger that's directed inward, and that's what depression is. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really been depressed. I was always a person, my whole life I'd always been active. I'd done martial arts since I was 11, always very, you know, very active. But going from like this super like human echelon of this very elite unit preparing to go to war, and then going from that to not even being able to walk again, it completely blindsided me. Being in that position, I had to find something to be thankful for. The only thing that I could think of at that moment was that if this had happened and I would have gotten other men killed who were trying to save me, if I was deployed at the time, for example, then that was something to be to be grateful for. And once I was able to build that one pillar, then I could, okay, now I can think of the next thing. Okay, well, at least I had the cognitive ability to realize what's going on. There were many people that were deployed that had traumatic brain injury or injured much worse than I was, and at least cognitively. So again, I was like, well, that's something else to be thankful for.
So let me, I'm sorry to interrupt your please, story, because please. These are fascinating things. These are things that I'd love to hear about, and that, not the tragedies, but how you overcame them. And when you start thinking that, when you went to that, hey, at least it didn't happen while I was deployed, did you really believe it at that time, or did you have to contemplate that over and over again before it became a sincere belief of gratitude?
Well, I got to the point where I was so depressed that I was thinking about committing suicide. I would have committed suicide if I was able. So like you were saying, there were parts of me that wish I didn't come back from the table.
Right.
But I couldn't even commit suicide because I was paralyzed. So I realized there was no other choice here. I had to do it. I had to figure something out. The other thing is, it's very different. We're all going to die at some point. We all know this. We all have an expiration date. But being in a bed, knowing that you have another 30 or 40 years of your life, mm-hmm. and you can't move, that's when you start getting that perspective. You shift your priorities. You figure out, just like you when you were in the avalanche, right. You figured out what was really important really quickly.
Right.
And that's what happened. So by being, like you were saying, once I became grateful and I was like, well, there has to be something I can learn from this adversity. What is the gift? What is the gift of this adversity? And I was being thankful for, again, other people not dying, trying to save
sure.
me. Being thankful that I had at least my mind to do this. And then about a week and a half later, out of nowhere, my left hand started moving just a little bit.
Now, do you believe that was out of nowhere, or do you sense that it has that was an effect of a cause that you started in your mind?
That's the only thing that I can attribute it to. I've talked to different people and they've said, oh, well, the reason why you're able to do that was because it would have happened anyway. It was just a coincidence. That's possible. But in my mind, it was a decision. It was a conscientious decision on my part.
Right.
Instead of fighting it, to just accept it. I learned in the military, I learned from martial arts that when you're facing something that you don't want to do, if mentally you are still resisting it, it's harder.
Right. The pain is in the resistance, not the doing or accepting.
That's exactly it. But once I got to the point where, because that was my obstruction, was my mentality.
Right.
And once I was able to pull that negative mentality away and just allow my body to do what it needs to do. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's the specific thing that happened, but I'm saying that that's what I did. And the results that occurred is why we're having this conversation right now.
So what's interesting is to what you, and I'm going to use you as an example because, Marcus, we're talking to you. I'm talking to you. So, right. So as opposed to somebody else, the resistance, what was there was you were resisting being paralyzed. By giving that more energy, you continued to be paralyzed. The resistance was causing the pain. But when you released it, and I'm not saying accepted that you were going to be paralyzed, but released the resistance to it, your body and your mind and your soul was able to take over and do what it should have done. That's my encapsulation of what you just said.
I absolutely agree. You were mentioning resistance. Like Pressfield, he talks about resistance in the war of art. I think of adversity as resistance, but I think of it as resistance's much bigger, meaner brother. With the adversity, you don't have a choice. It pushes you down. It doesn't take no for an answer. So I had to, as you said, I had to accept that as opposed to trying to resist against it. Once I was able to do that, that gave me the capacity, I believe, to start healing and start evolving into where I am currently.
So you feel your hand starts to move. What happens over the next several days, weeks, and months to get you to where you are now?
It was hard because I wanted to be so excited, but I was afraid to have my soul crushed again, to have it not happen. Yep. So I went back to the therapist the next day and told them what happened, and they were like, okay, let's see it. Well, I couldn't really do it at that point. So again, I just kind of slowly made those small movements forward. Eventually the hand started moving. Eventually I started feeling pain, which is horrible, but at least it's better than numbness.
Right.
And then eventually, after about 6 months, I was to the point where I could actually sort of move on my own. I could use a walker. And at that point, that's when I started realizing, okay, this is what I'm going to start. I've made that decision to, this is what I want to start doing with my life. During the TED Talk, I asked those three questions about, you know, if you put yourself in that position, you know, what would you do if you could actually walk after you found yourself paralyzed? And nobody really takes that time or that perspective to think about it. But mm-hmm. in my position, I didn't have a choice. So when I started thinking about it, it really made me evaluate what's actually important. It made me actually take that perspective to figure out what I really wanted to do next. The hard part was waiting around to see what they wanted to do with me in the military, when they were going to release me, how they were going to release me, at what point it was going to happen. Right. At that point, once I got out, I was still, even though I wasn't completely recovered, obviously, even now, I still have permanent damage on my hands and my feet. I can't really feel very well. But I went back to my love of the martial arts as, in my mind, a form of therapy. Mm-hmm. So doing Jeet Kune Do, Bruce Lee's martial art, doing Kali, doing things with weapons and stuff, it forced me to use those extremities, use those movements, use that proprioception. And that helped me a tremendous amount. I'm an instructor in Jeet Kune Do under Bruce Lee's protege. His name's Guru Dan Inosanto.
Oh, I know Dan from Southern California.
He's a Marina del Rey, yes. Yeah. And so I'm very honored to be an instructor under him. I get to go out and train with him, you know, multiple times a year, or I'll train with him in seminars. And so he's 81 years old, and that guy is an inspiration. So he said a long time ago, I remember him telling me, he says, Marcus, the body that you have when you're 40 is not the body that you're going to have when you're 50. And the body that you have when you're 50 is not the body you're going to have when you're 60. And he said that when I was like in my 30s. So I was like, okay, Guru, yeah, that sounds great. Right. But I didn't really believe it. And then once I got hurt, then I started realizing now the wisdom is like, wow, he really knows what he's talking about. Right. So you're constantly reinventing yourself. That's why it's so important to learn, to be humble, to want to absorb the truth and what you find. Right. And that's what I'm doing now.
So let me ask you, the thing with the military is it forces individuals to be mentally strong, mentally tough. And there's a lot of people out there, Mark Devine, I don't know if you know Mark or familiar with Mark of SEALFIT. I interviewed Mark. And all of the military folks have wonderful lessons to teach us. The challenge is they teach them from their own personal experience of adversity. So for the average citizen, the civilian, who doesn't have that adversity to draw upon, how do you help them using your military, your survival, I'm going to call it your survival instincts from that, and your martial arts? How do you use that to help your clients and individuals achieve that mental strength, that mental toughness, if they don't have that adversity in their life?
Of course. The way I tell them is I just tell them that adversity is opportunity in disguise. Mm-hmm. So many people will go through, and like you say, or like I was saying in my TED Talks, people try to avoid the adversity. But by trying to avoid it, you're not able to actually go the direction you need to go. If you go to the gym, for example, and you don't try to put more weight on the bar or lift faster or run faster, if you don't embrace that adversity, you will never get better. The adversity is what forces you to adapt into somebody who is stronger, who is more resilient. So, and adversity is relative. So it's not a competition. So I try to get all my clients to understand, listen, adversity is your best teacher. So go forward into that, embrace that, figure out what you can get from this adversity and seek it out voluntarily. your adversity is almost like your immune system. If you don't do something to condition it, to strengthen it, when you actually do run into something very, very powerful, like a horrible flu or whatever, it may kill you. So it's important to learn about that adversity now and embrace it as much as you can to get yourself into a position where you are more likely to get
so strong. Almost get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
That's the cliche that everybody says, or we always would say, embrace the suck.
Right, embrace the suck. Right, embrace we say that at CrossFit a lot too.
Yeah, you have to do it like that. I would just say that instead of trying to resist it, try to go with it and try to take what you can from it. A lot of my TED talk is from my book.
How do you correlate? You know, when you talked about the weights and stuff, and there's for me, I love CrossFit. I love training. So that adversity is actually pleasure. I don't even look at it as adversity, as pleasure. There are other things in my life that may be adversity, and I look at it as not pleasurable. So I work on myself on that. But, you know, if you have a client or you're talking to a group of people and they go, hey, we can do workout, we can lift. How do you help them? This has been one of the challenges I've been facing is how do you take something that somebody loves as adversity, like lifting and CrossFit, and help them take that same mindset and apply it elsewhere in their life?
That's what I try to do is I try to show them the shift. I try to show them that similarity.
Yeah.
I try to show them that the adversity that they're facing is just a battle of semantics. Mm-hmm. So like you're saying, it's the same thing. I talk about the physical manifestation of adversity being an adversary. So that's how you look at it. That's when you learn the most about it. Examine yourself. Examine the way you look when you face adversity and think to yourself, why am I feeling like this? Why am I not able to embrace this? Why am I not able to accept this? Mm-hmm. And then go further in and go deeper in and understand why. Are you afraid? What are you afraid of?
Is that what you asked yourself during that the rehab time? Were those some of the questions that you asked yourself?
I did. I kept telling myself, okay, well, is this worse than dying? No. So that's what I did. I just gave myself like this adversity gauge and then compared it to what I've done before. And I just kept pushing myself in that manner. Now, for a person, like you said, who is a civilian or who hasn't had to push themselves, that's why it's hard for them to grow because they're not actually facing that adversity.
Mm.
So adversity can be something that we can dictate at our own pace. So even if I have a conversation with somebody that I don't agree with about a specific subject, for example, that is a way for me to embrace that adversity. Why? Why do I not understand? Why am I not agreeing with that person? Just that small thing. It's a small step to help you do that. Maybe then the next time you can say to yourself, you know what? It's cold outside. I'm not going to get frostbite if I don't wear my jacket, though. I'm going to walk without my jacket from my car to my employment area. That's not really that hard, but it's those small things. You can do all kinds of things and just ramp it up as much as you want. So like you said with CrossFit, you're trying to hit that time. You're trying to do Murph faster. You're trying to do these things, right?
We said, I'm trying to finish Murph, not do it faster.
Exactly. And again, that's why adversity is relative, right? So,
right. But I'd like what you just said about when you're in a conversation. Because again, for those that may be not physically active, which I highly encourage, I encourage that that's the best way to challenge ourselves with adversity. It's you go to a CrossFit box or even to a gym, you put yourself underneath there, then you translate it. But I loved what you said about if you're having a discussion, and sometimes people think the word conflict is a bad thing. But, you know, when we're in a conversation and there's a conflict there, to use that for self-examination to help grow. I thought that was a marvelous idea.
That's it. That's the catalyst. And if you look at it as such, then you're going to be fine. When we have a discussion that people are very passionate about, that's whenever feelings get hurt and that's whenever it's hard for us to see it for what it is.
Right.
But instead of going at the person and saying, I disagree with you, try to open up and say, okay, well, why do you feel that way? If you and I have a discussion and I don't agree with you and I say that, it puts you in a defensive position.
Right.
And then to you, you feel like, okay, he doesn't agree with me with this. That means he doesn't agree with all these other things. That means he doesn't agree with the way I was raised. That means he doesn't like my parents. That means so many things, and that's what happens. Right. But if I can come to you and say something, and you are wise enough and strong enough to say, well, why does he feel that way? Why does he feel like that? That helps us. Again, that's a form of adversity, and you can find adversity in anything if you're willing to look for it. But most of us, especially in society, they don't want to do that. They want to just kind of go about their lives,
Right.
Keep themselves preoccupied with whatever it is.
And yet, but what's interesting is those that don't face adversity or hide from it are often the ones that complain that they're not growing in their life. How come they don't have any friends? How come they don't have any money? How come they don't have any other things in their life? But the reason is that they're afraid to face adversity or conflict and use that as a mechanism to grow.
That's exactly what it is. Adversity, like I said, is an opportunity. And without having that opportunity, everybody wants to have the knowledge, but they don't want to put in the time.
Right.
Everybody wants the right, but they don't want the responsibility. Unfortunately, in the world, in nature, in reality, you cannot have one without the other. Even in, just like what we're talking about the warrior mentality. So if you look through Buddhism, through Buddha with the samurai, mm-hmm. you look at the Greeks, you look at modern warfare as well, that stoicism, that mentality is always there. But the reason why it always comes up is because it's always functional, it's always practical, and it's always useful. It's easy to read somebody else's quotes and be like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and do that. But then whenever you actually run into it, can you apply it? Yeah. And that's what separates that's what separates learning from actually wanting to learn.
That separates the warriors from the victims.
It does. And the victim mentality is very easy to pick up. That's what I told myself. I was like, I can just be a victim for the rest of my life. Or I can do something, and I've never been the guy that sit on my ass and want somebody to pity me. Don't do that.
So do you attribute that? Because I mean, it would have been very easy for you, and we just talked before we started to record about Jeanine Shepherd. It would have been very easy for her to play the victim. It would have been extremely easy for you to play the victim. What do you account that mindset of being the warrior? I call it the warrior versus victim. Do you attribute it to the way you were raised, your own belief, martial arts, a little bit of everything?
I think it was a little bit of anything, a little bit of everything. I had two growing up. My father was a very strong role model. My great uncle was in special forces in Vietnam as well. Mm-hmm. So they were both very strong role models, and they were very much about the work ethic, about being strong. Martial arts at 11 years old, they're teaching you, you know, self-control, perseverance, humility, indomitable spirit. And then you're putting it into practice. When I was 11 years old, I started martial arts. When I was 13, I was allowed to go to the adult class. And I loved that. Wow. But they told me, listen, the adult class, we take it up a notch. So I'm in Oklahoma in the heat, in the middle of the heat wave in July. And I've done the kids class. I run as fast as I can because you bow in, you bow back out. I run over there, get some water, and get to the adults class. About halfway through the adult class, I've got to use the restroom. So I go to the instructor. I'm at attention. I'm waiting for him. And he says, yes. And I said, can I use the restroom? And he said, do 50 push-ups first. So I start doing push-ups. I get to 20. He says, do them on your knuckles. So now I have to start over. And again, that's where I started learning that, man, I don't want to do this. But I learned that if I mentally resisted it, I wouldn't be able to finish.
Right, right.
It was difficult. 13 years old, I got my push-ups done. But that's where I learned that resilience. I stand back up. I'm in attention. I'm ready to go to the restroom. Right. And I said, can I use the restroom now? He says, no. The 50 push-ups was because you asked. So now I have a choice, right? I can either sit there and be a victim by this and be upset about it, or I can suck it up and finish class.
Right.
I sucked it up. I finished class. I ran to the bathroom as soon as we were done.
Sure.
But that's where you start getting that. And that was sort of a definitive moment for me when it came to understanding this is discipline. This is not punishment. This is just discipline.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's the way I saw it.
So again, just to revisit this, that for those folks who haven't experienced, I mean, I was been in martial arts for, I did Tang Soo for quite many years and Bujikan and some other ones. And it's wonderful. It creates this discipline and this mentality around it. And there's others that don't have any of this background. And it's so easy to fall into that victim mentality on, you know, whether the government's not taking care of me, my boss stinks, my significant other doesn't understand me, whatever that might be. Again, just how would you coach somebody like that or a group of people who are listening to going, hey, that's great for you, Marcus and Greg, but you have all this background and stuff. I don't have any of that. What can I draw upon?
That's what I would tell them, to go out again. And if they can do something physical to reach that point where they're uncomfortable, it's like, this is the introduction to it. This is your adversity. If they go out, like you say, even if they're not physical, if they can have a conversation, if they can read something that makes them face some sort of adversity, the pain and discomfort are always the best teachers. Always, always, always. And we face those most of the time physically. But if you're not able to do it physically, or if they just don't want to do it physically, that's fine. They can still find a way to do it by reading something or looking at something intellectually that, again, is something that they oppose, and then find the reason, the way to get through that by understanding, or again, reading stories about, I don't want to say my story, but there are many other people. In my TED Talk, I just want people to realize, one, that they are stronger than they believe they are. Mm-hmm. They have so much more strength than they give themselves credit for. Yep. And two, that here in the U.S. or anywhere that's a first world country, you have it really good.
Right.
So by looking at other people's adversity, you can do that. My story should be a vicarious cautionary tale to make them see. It's like, listen, this is what somebody can do if they're pushed to that point. I don't want you to have to be pushed to that point.
Right.
But whatever your adversity is, go to the edge of that and then push yourself.
Would you suggest that, and you gave some more good points there about reading something or something that you may not normally read. Would you give the advice of sensing the emotions that a person has when they're reading something that they don't agree with and use that as the adversity as opposed to going, this is baloney, this is whatever it is, and just throw the book down and walk away?
Absolutely. That's what you have to do. And it depends on the relationship between you and the client, right?
Right.
There's some clients that if I push them physically, they can do that all day. But just like you said, if I give them this intellectual adversity, that's when they have a hard time and they just want to shut it off.
Right.
And that's when you have to turn into it. That's when you have to embrace it and say, why? Why do I not like this? What do I not like about this? How can I get better at this? How can I figure out, how can I deconstruct this? Because if I don't figure out why, that will always be my limitation. That will always be my plateau.
Right. I call it mental resistance. So I have this concept of mental support and mental resistance, and we go back and forth. The mental support is where we hit rock bottom, whether it's in a relationship, money, physical weight, or whatever. And the mental resistance is a stopping point where we hold ourselves back based on our beliefs, past experiences, etc. Now, mental support, you pretty much hit rock bottom when you're on the table, right? So you have a lot of upside to that. How do you keep yes. pushing yourself past your own mental resistance?
There was a quote that Bruce Lee said. He says, there are no such things as limits. There are only plateaus.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are able to look away, pull away from a large enough view, we can see that it is a plateau. But most people give up before they get to that point where they can go to the next level.
Yep.
So that's the way I look at it. It's easy to be philosophical about it, but it's hard to embrace it when it's happening. But that's what I do. I look at what I'm doing and I say, well, okay, am I mentally stopping? Do I not believe it? And I'm still going through the motions. And because I don't believe it, I'm not actually committing. There's but one level of commitment, Greg, and that's total, right?
Yep.
So if you don't commit totally to it, you're not going to get there.
That's the difference between the chicken and the pig, right? For breakfast, the chicken is participating. The pig is fully committed.
That's exactly it. That's what it is. So you have to find that whatever your form of commitment is, how you get to that point. Right. Once you realize that you are committed to it, that's when you start realizing again, oh, look, I'm making progress now. Oh, I thought I plateaued, but wow, because I actually believe it. So it's not always about the quantity of the movement. It's about the quality. It's mm-hmm. about the amount of commitment that you're willing to give at that point. Just like with CrossFit, right? If you're doing Tabatas, if you're doing something like that, you're crushing your system, but you're doing it quickly. And that's where you get the results from.
Yep.
You can get on a treadmill for an hour and burn as many calories as you do doing Tabata burpee box jumps, but you're not going to get the same kind of results as doing that, right?
Yep,
so
yep.
That's what it is. You have to embrace that.
So what does a typical week look like for you? Not necessarily work-wise, but self-development, pushing yourself past your mental resistance. What does that look like?
For me, martial arts helps an awful lot. And whether it be in a Kali class where I'm using sticks and knives, whether it be jiu-jitsu where I'm on the ground, rolling with somebody that's actually trying to choke you or break your arm,
yep.
Standing up and sparring, whatever it is. But for me, I'm finishing my book right now, so that's where a lot of it is.
Yep.
But I'm always trying to ingest as much quality as I can when it comes to those things. So looking at Marcus Aurelius's writings, going back over what, you know, Pressfield has said about his form of resistance, and then going through and revisiting things that makes me get better, reading new books, reading what other people have to say. Truth is something that's universal, but it is our evolution of it that always changes is how much of it I can actually recognize from other sources. Mm-hmm. So by going through and reading another person's book or hearing somebody else's story, that's what helps me get to that point where I can actually evolve. And the minute you stop learning is when you stop growing. Yeah. So if I'm a teacher, if I'm a coach, that means I need to be a pupil before I'm anything else.
Right.
So I have to constantly empty my cup and constantly, as you're saying, replenish it with as much quality knowledge as I possibly can.
Fantastic. Marcus, this has been an amazing conversation. I don't want to take up much more of your time, but please let the listeners know how to contact you, some of the things that you have out there as far as offerings. I know you just said you're finishing up on your book, but do you have coaching programs, and how can people get in touch with you?
Absolutely. I'm finishing up my book now. My book is going to be called The Gift of Adversity. I named it The Gift of Adversity because it was the name of my TED Talk. And if you like the TED Talk, what I say in it, a lot of it's in the book. That book will be out in August. If you're trying to find me, you can find me at MarcusAureliusAnderson.com, just my name.com. Mm-hmm. And there I have, like you said, I have some coaching availability for that. That's where you're going to find my book. You'll find my TED Talk there. If you look at me on LinkedIn, you'll find more information there. That's where you and I connected.
Yep.
And if you go to my website, that's when you can find out more about that. You can get on my mailing list and find out more about the book coming out. I'll be giving special offers for your listenership as well.
Great. Thank
so that
you.
They can actually buy the book and then get some other things to go with it as well. So
fantastic. Marcus, again, thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope we can do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been enlightening on my end as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Warrior Mind podcast. If you liked what you've heard, please tell your friends and subscribe by your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. Also, make sure you check out www.warriormindtraining.com. Until next time, live with courage. And remember, every facet, every compartment of your mind is to be programmed by you. And unless you take your rightful responsibility to program your own mind, the world will program it for you.